awareness of this problem. I mean, I've been working on this issue for nearly 20 years, and when I started, nobody really knew about these abuses. No one had heard of the kafala system, and it just wasn't an issue at all. Qatar has changed that. Qatar has become a lightning rod for focus on this issue and criticism of this issue, and that has led to some changes on paper, at least. You know, there have been reforms to the kafala system, legal abolition effect, in effect, but sadly that hasn't really been complemented by the necessary political will to make that effective. And as your piece rightly identified, you know, it's come a lot far too late for all these families who've lost family members in circumstances that have just not been explained to them. So I tend to look at these tremendous human harms and the appalling impact it's had on people like the family of the man in your piece, and I find it hard to draw particular optimism
Nick, before we go, we only have 10 seconds. I want to ask Ziad, has the Jordanian government intervened on your brother's behalf?
No, unfortunately, they just visited him once in prison, and after that, they refrained. They never intervened on the case.
And when do you expect him to be released?
Well, I hope he will be released soon, because with this pressure, the Qataris might reach an understanding that Abdullah is becoming a burden and he's in prison for nothing wrong he did, only for a political decision. And we hope it will be soon.
Ziad Abihaiz, I want to thank you so much for being with us, brother of Abdullah, who's in prison in Qatar for exposing worker abuses, and Nick McGeehan, co-director and co-founder of the human rights group Fair Square. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kbu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Community Advisory Board will meet Thursday, December 22nd from 6 to 8 p.m. The meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. At this time, masks are required for in-person attendees.
KBOO's End of Your Drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Contribute now and help us meet our $70,000 goal by the end of the year. Join the KBOO family today at kboo.fm/give.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we continue our Cosmology on Sojourner Truth series. In a one-hour special, we discuss black holes, axions, neutron stars, the physics of melanin, decolonizing science, racism in science, and more with Dr. Chanda Prescott Weinstein, a particle physicist. In her current position, she is a research associate in theoretical physics at the University of Washington. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnestad. President Joe Biden will sign the Respect for Marriage Act today, a bill that enshrines protections for same-sex unions in federal law. Lawmakers say they were motivated by the possibility the U.S. Supreme Court could overturn gay marriage rights, much like conservative justices already did with nationwide abortion access. The bill also provides federal protections for interracial marriages. The Securities and Exchange Commission has charged the former CEO of failed cryptocurrency firm FTX with orchestrating a scheme to defraud investors. A civil complaint filed today alleges Sam Bankman-Fried raised more than $1.8 billion from equity investors since May of 2019 by promoting FTX as a safe, responsible platform for trading crypto assets. It also says he diverted customer funds to Alameda Research LLC, a privately held crypto fund, without telling the investors, and that he committed their funds to make undisclosed venture investments, lavish real estate purchases, and large political donations. He was arrested in the Bahamas Monday. The firm filed for bankruptcy last month when it ran out of money. Its current CEO, John Ray III, will testify before a House Financial Services Committee today. The clock is ticking. Congress faces a government shutdown deadline at the end of this week as lawmakers and the White House race to reach a deal to keep the government operating. Max Pringle reports.
Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said funding for critical services could dry up.
Both sides are going to have to give in order to get it done. But it'll be worth it if it means doing right by our veterans, our service members in uniforms, our kids, their families. That's what's at stake here.
Lawmakers had hoped to wrap up their work in the lame duck session by Friday, but are now making plans to stay around right up until the Christmas weekend. Some say they may also have to return to Washington the week after that. Senate leaders said the two parties are about $26 billion apart on domestic spending. The omnibus package would likely be more than $1.5 trillion. Democrats want parity between domestic and defense spending. Republicans are pushing to pare back the domestic number because of billions in new spending on COVID relief and anti-inflation measures. Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
If House and Senate Democratic colleagues can accept these realities in the very near future, we may still have a shot at assembling a full-year funding bill that will give our military commanders the certainty they need and stay competitive with rivals like China.
Congress must fund the government before Saturday to avoid a shutdown. I'm Max Pringle.
Jurors in Washington, D.C. heard a prosecutor's opening statements for a second seditious conspiracy trial against members of the far-right Oath Keepers group charged in the deadly Capitol attack on January 6th. The trial began Monday and comes less than 2 weeks after a different jury convicted Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes and Florida chapter leader Kelly Meggs of seditious conspiracy for what prosecutors described as a violent plot to overturn President Joe Biden's election win. They face 20 years in prison. Meanwhile, a new report finds more than 300 people on a leaked Oath Keepers membership list were listed as government employees, current or former, at the Department of Homeland Security agencies, including the Border Patrol, Coast Guard, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the Secret Service. The DHS has said far-right extremists pose the greatest domestic threat, but ironically, now has many people aligned with such groups working or once worked at its own agencies, some responsible for combating extremism. The Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project and the Project on Government Oversight launched that investigation. Belgian police conducted raids at European Parliament offices Monday as part of a fraud investigation. They're investigating alleged influence peddling by a Gulf country. Over the weekend, European Parliament charged 4 people with corruption, participating in a criminal group, and money laundering. Parliament's vice president was relieved of her duties. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has pressed Western leaders to provide more advanced weapons to help his country in its war with Russia, as he repeated calls for Russian forces to withdraw from occupied areas of Ukraine, suggesting Christmas as a date to retreat. His comments were translated by Al Jazeera.
I propose to convene a special summit, the Global Peace Formula Summit, to decide how and when we can implement the points of the Ukrainian peace formula. I suggest that you show leadership in the implementation of a peace formula, and we suggest that Russia takes a concrete, meaningful step towards a diplomatic solution, which is so often talked about in Moscow.
Despite his calls for negotiations, he also pressed for more war material, echoing his prime minister's appeal Sunday for long-range missiles, modern tanks, artillery, and missile batteries, and other high-tech air defense systems. A former Libyan intelligence official accused of making the bomb that brought down Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, in 1988, appeared in federal court in Washington to face charges of international terrorism Monday. The Justice Department announced Sunday Abu Aguila Mohammed Massoud Kher al-Marimi had been taken into custody 2 years after it revealed it had charged him in connection with the explosion. I'm Christina Onestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Our news headlines, and we are today continuing our Cosmology on Sojourner Truth series, a popular series. We haven't done one in a while, and we do have a one-hour special where we're going to be discussing all kinds of things: black holes, axions, neutron stars, the physics of melanin, and race, racism in science, decolonizing science, and more. And I'd like to welcome our guest, Chanda Prescott-Weinstein, has a bachelor's degree in physics, astronomy, and astrophysics from Harvard University, a master's in astrophysics from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and a PhD in theoretical physics at the Perimeter Institute. After receiving her PhD, she served a stint at NASA and then moved on to MIT as the MLK Scholar. She is, by the way, also the editor of The Offing, which is an online literary magazine. She is one of very few black women who have earned a PhD in physics, and because of this has become a strong advocate for changing the face of physics. That's one of the few black women in the United States. When she's not calculating or fighting discrimination, she also works on philosophical questions relating to how science is affected when people of color are excluded from or participating in it. And for full disclosure, she is my daughter. Chanda, welcome.
Thanks, Mom. Nice to be in conversation with you.
Yeah, and I'll have to say, for the longest time, I put off doing this kind of interview with Chanda simply because she is my daughter. But I consulted, of course, with the program director here and got the thumbs up that, of course, we have to get you on the air, Chanda. Your body of work is large as it is, and it is expanding. So we have quite a lot to talk about. And Chanda, I'd like to start out by talking about the philosophy of science work. What is that? What are you doing with that?
So I should start by saying that I am one of those people who used to think that philosophy was kind of, highfalutin. It wasn't really for me, and I thought it was for people who were much deeper thinkers than I was, or much more concerned with issues that were distant from the grassroots. And so I sort of fell into doing philosophy as I became more focused on trying to understand some of the grassroots issues that I was dealing with. And so to be more specific about that, there has been ongoing controversy about the use of indigenous lands to do astronomy research. For example, building a telescope on Mauna Wakea, which is sacred land, at least from some people's point of view, in Hawaii. And I ended up kind of in the middle of this debate about it and was trying to better understand how I could give this discussion context. And being an academic, I have a natural proclivity to try and understand, like, what have academics said about these things in the past? And what is the connection between how academics have talked about these things and the grassroots activism of the Native Hawaiians who are organizing against the building of telescopes on their land? And so I became curious. Part of the debate ended up centering around, some people were claiming this is a science versus religion debate. And for the most part, organizers on the ground really objected to that framing of it. They said, no, this is about different ways of knowing, different types of knowledge, and maybe even different types of science. And so I became very interested in the question of how do we define science? Is science only when people who have kind of a European intellectual lineage doing the work? Can we call other things science? When we call those other things science, is that colonial? by labeling them using this European-derived word. And so that's really where the philosophy kind of came in, is trying to understand what does it all mean even when we use this language, and what impact does that have on marginalized communities, people who have been opposing colonialism, and what impact does that have on the kinds of scientific questions that we ask.
Right, and you have a grant now working in this area, is that right?
Yes, I have a grant from FQXI, which is an organization that funds questions in foundational physics. The program that the grant is through is the Physics of the Observer program. And so the grant I'm principal investigator, my co-investigator is Professor Sarah Tuttle, who is a telescope builder and astronomer at the University of Washington in the Department of Astronomy. And so we were interested in how are observers constructed, and we kind of wanted to construe this broadly. Someone who uses a telescope in astronomy is called an observer, so that's one definition. But we were interested also in the question of how Native people and more broadly people of color, for example, Black women like myself, are unconstructed as observers. So we're fundamentally told that we cannot be objective, particularly when it comes to conversations about science and race. And so we were broadly interested in how does it affect, as I was saying before, the kinds of scientific questions that we ask when certain people are included, generally speaking, white, cisgender men who are also straight. And what does it mean when we exclude other people who are having different experiences and maybe other ways of knowing associated with those different experiences?
Right. Well, Chanda, wasn't it your third grade teacher, or was it fourth grade, Mr. Wilson, that I guess this is the mom and me coming out here, that had actually said he thought that the philosophy of science, or maybe the philosophy of physics, I can't remember which one, might be something that you may be interested in?
I do remember that. So Mr. Wilson was my fifth grade science teacher.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Mr. Wilson was my fifth grade science teacher. He was then also my pre-algebra teacher in sixth grade and my algebra and physical science teacher
in
seventh grade. At 32nd Street, at USC, LAUSD, Magnet for Visual and Performing Arts, where I went for first through seventh grade. And actually, Mr. Wilson is now the chair of the math department at the Los Angeles Center for Enriched Studies, which is where I went to high school, although I never actually took classes from him when I was at LACES. And so my senior year of high school, I was applying to college. He had gone to Harvard and I was applying to Harvard. So I asked him if he would write me a letter of recommendation, since he had played such an important role, in fact, introducing me to science. And he made a point of ensuring that I read the letter of recommendation. And in the letter of recommendation, he said that while he believed I had capacity to make contributions to cosmology, which is my scientific area of expertise now, that he thought my contributions to the philosophy of science might be more significant. I was pretty resentful about that, actually. Maybe ironically. Even now, I hope that my contributions will be in both and not just one or the other.
All right. And again, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we're having a special, a continuation of our occasional series, Cosmology, on Sojourner Truth. And our guest is Dr. Chanda Prescott-Weinstein, a research associate in theoretical physics at the University of Washington. Again, for full disclosure, you likely recognize Prescott in there. Yes, she is my daughter. Chanda, also, just quickly tell us then, I mean, you grew up in a family of activists, right, on both sides, your mom, me, and your dad. How did you fall in love with science and physics in particular, and cosmology and astrophysics and all that? How did that happen? Because I remember at a very young age, you were already into it.
Yeah, so I actually kind of wondered if you knew the story or sort of the backstory, but the way that I got excited about math was when I started at 32nd Street in first grade. There was a girl in my class, I even remember her name, it was Anna, who was a year younger than everybody else, but already knew how to do something called multiplication. And I was sort of outraged that somebody in my class knew how to do something that I didn't know how to do. So I came home and I insisted to my dad that he teach me how to do multiplication, because there was just no way I was going to let her be the only one in the class who knew how to do it. And so he explained multiplication to me, and I became basically obsessed with it. I used to sort of, you know, sit in my after school program and just write out my times tables. And I just thought the pattern was fascinating. The connection between this cross, this X symbol, I guess is what we use, and the fact that, you know, every time I added a number, I added two. So I loved writing like 2 times 2 is 4, 2 times 3 is 6, and watching that pattern. And so my interest in math started there. And then, of course, you know, your mother, my grandmother, who was a phenomenal teacher, really encouraged me and taught me how to do long division before I learned it at school. And so I think it became obvious to everyone that I had a thing with numbers and that I just really liked sitting and doing math. And then I ended up in this science class with Mr. Wilson for a month or two in fifth grade. And I've actually always wondered, so you took me to see A Brief History of Time, the Errol Morris documentary about Stephen Hawking. And that is how I first learned about theoretical physics and cosmology. And that's where I decided in the middle of the film that that was the career I was going to have. And I've never known if you took me to that documentary of your own volition, or if that was something that Mr. Wilson had suggested that you do.
No, my dear, that was me. That was your mom, because actually I wanted to see the film myself also. But also to just tell you about the numbers thing, I mean, when you were a little thing watching Sesame Street, your favorite character was the Count. You just love the Count, who would go around counting everything, right? So perhaps that was true.
I joked on Facebook the other day that I kind of miss the days when I thought that doing math was going to be hanging out with a purple vampire and a bunch of bats.
Right. Okay, so that's some of the philosophy of science work and your early start in all of this. Now, I know you write and you're very prolific, actually, about all kinds of things, from stories to poetry and everything else. But I want to focus a bit on your work, your science work right now. And there are a couple of things that perhaps you could help our audience to understand. And again, our guest is Dr. Chanda Prescott Weinstein, who is a theoretical physicist, a particle physicist, as Melissa Harris Perry, one of your fans, reminded me. She's like, Chanda is a particle physicist, right? But what I'd like to do is to just play a short clip that I found on dark matter. And let's see what you think of that and perhaps expand on it a little bit.
Astronomers have mapped a giant structure made of dark matter. It extends almost 60 million light years out from a huge galaxy cluster and is our best glimpse so far of the scaffolding that gives the universe its large-scale structure.
Now, in its very early years, the universe was extremely smooth and uniform. There were no stars and no galaxies, and all of the matter was distributed throughout the universe very, very evenly. Almost perfectly so. But not quite. Even back then, there were tiny variations in the density from place to place. And over time, these tiny fluctuations grew and condensed into a web-like pattern that pervades and give structure to the universe of today. Formed of vast filaments and sheets of dark matter, this structure is known to astronomers as the cosmic web. Now the trouble is, because it's made of dark matter, you can't actually see it when you look up into the sky. You can model it with computer simulations, but until very recently, it had only ever been observed indirectly.
Scientists know that less than a quarter of the matter in the universe is actually visible, in the form of stars, nebulae, gas, and so on. The majority is dark matter, which cannot be seen directly. Astronomers have had compelling evidence for the cosmic web for years, thanks to galaxies clustering along it. But directly observing the dark matter web itself has been far more difficult.
Just helping a layperson to understand this, I mean, an article I read, one I read had the title, "What the Hell is Dark Matter?" Right? But that roughly 80% of the mass of the universe made up of this material that scientists cannot directly observe. What did you think of the information in that clip? And do you have anything to add to it specifically on dark matter? I know that this could be like hours of discussion, so I don't mean it to be fully comprehensive, but just to help our audience along, anything you would like to say about it?
So the way that I like to talk about dark matter is to explain to people why we think that dark matter might exist. And I say might because we still, you know, haven't actually directly seen dark matter the way I can see my refrigerator, for example. I can look at it and tell you that it's there because I've seen it with my own eyes. I can feel it with my hands. There are different ways of knowing that the fridge is there. And we haven't had any of that kind of tactile interaction with dark matter. So what we know is that when we look at how stars are moving in a galaxy, this is really how dark matter was, evidence for dark matter was first found. We look at how stars are moving in a galaxy, and we expect them to be moving at a certain speed. And that speed is related to how many stars there are and how much matter is in the stars. And we can also measure how much matter there should be in the stars from looking at how much light that we get from them. And so what we came to realize was that there was a mismatch between the movement of the stars and how much matter we expected based on the movement and how much matter we expect based on the light. And so this implied that there was a bunch of matter that we couldn't see. And that's really when people say dark matter, that's what they mean, is that it doesn't emit light. And so, and this is kind of, you know, this is considered gravitational evidence because this is all based on how gravity affects the movements of the stars. So one thing that I like to clear up is while we, often when we talk to the general public about dark matter, we say that it has no interactions with regular matter, but actually we hope that it does have some very mild interactions with regular matter, because we actually spend a lot of money on what are called direct detection experiments, where we're hoping to catch a dark matter particle in an experiment. So it's not quite true that there's no interaction with other forms of matter, we think, but we really don't know. And it's also still not out of the realm of possibility that our theory of gravity is wrong. I'm not a particular advocate for that approach, but that's something that people continuously talk about, that maybe the problem isn't that there's some form of matter that we've never seen, but that we're interpreting the data incorrectly. And this is always a challenge with scientific research, and this is especially a challenge with astrophysical research, where, you know, we can't just take a spaceship out to the nether regions and go collect the data ourselves, and we can't do the experiment again.
Right. And also, Chanda, there's a lot of mixing up. Is dark matter and dark energy the same?
No, they're completely different. And, you know, one of the things, the philosopher side of me is always very fascinated by the nomenclature of the language that we use to describe these things. And my friends will tell you that I've said on more than one occasion that if a black scientist was in charge, I'm not sure that they would have called either of them dark energy or dark matter. I don't know. I'm not sure that's the name that I would have come up with.
Yeah.
Or black holes. Dark energy actually... Right. Or black holes. So dark energy is relates to the expansion of space-time. And so it's a completely different phenomenon. And it's, again, something we don't know if the dark energy is real or if something else is causing space-time expansion to accelerate. But they're actually completely different. And I agree it can be confusing because we use such similar language to talk about them. And, you know, I can think of other examples, like when we're talking about particle physics, when we're talking about quarks, this is sometimes called colored physics. because this is the nomenclature that white men came up with when they were first discovering the science. And of course, you know, people probably cringed when I said that. I cringe every time I read it in a textbook. But there really is kind of even these embedded things about language that can be confusing for the general public and also signal who was involved in doing making the science happen.
Right. And from what I could gather, it seems as though dark energy dominates the universe. Is that right?
Yes. If dark energy is driving cosmic acceleration, it would be the dominant, what we would call, matter-energy component that makes up all of the matter-energy in the universe. But I would say that this is a problem that we really don't understand, and a lot of people are very dissatisfied with the current dark energy solutions that we have. I would also say it causes people to be very depressed sometimes that we will never solve this problem. I think it's a big source of stress for people.
What is cosmic acceleration?
So cosmic acceleration, so something that was discovered in the 1920s is that space-time, the universe itself, is expanding. So you will often hear this as galaxies are flying away from each other. I think a better way of putting it is that the space-time between galaxies is expanding. And I realize that's really bizarre and kind of outside of our, you know, everyday intuition about how things work, because to return to my refrigerator is not expanding away from me, so how can space-time be expanding? So this is a phenomenon that happens on very large scales, so not on the scales of our everyday life, but the scales of galaxies and the space between galaxies. So it was discovered in the 1920s that the universe was expanding. And then actually my senior year of high school, so as I was going through this process of applying for college, it was announced that using star explosions, what we call supernovae, scientists had figured out that the expansion was accelerating. So it was actually picking up speed. And the only way, this was totally inconsistent with all of our theories about the shape and structure of space-time, unless we added something that looks like a dark energy. And so that's really where the dark energy comes from, is it's just trying to make Einstein's equation work, because Einstein's equation is what tells us about space-time. So basically, people now have lots of theories about exactly how the dark energy works, and in the next 10, 15 years, we have a lot of experiments coming online to try and distinguish between some of these theories.
Right, and our guest is Dr. Chanda Prescott-Weinstein, and she is a theoretical physicist, a particle physicist in particular. She's now a research associate in theoretical physics at the University of Washington. This is your host of Sojourner Truth, Margaret Prescott. Now, Chanda, before we go to have to take a short station break, you are going to be part of a neutron star structure team. So tell us what that is. You'll be collaborating with, I guess it's a NASA project, something called STROBE-X. Tell us what that is. I mean, what are you going to be doing there?
So I'm actually on three different what are called X-ray probes. So I think most people are familiar with X-rays, like you go to the doctor and they put you in front of a machine and the machine shoots X-rays at your body, and that allows us to see past your skin and flesh to see like if you have a broken bone or something like that. And you know, CT scans work using a similar phenomenon. So the X-rays, X-rays are actually also emitted by our sun, but the atmosphere protects us from them, and so most of those X-rays get filtered out. And X-rays are also emitted by a lot of astrophysical objects, so galaxies emit them, and neutron stars emit them. And so in order to do X-ray astronomy, we have to get telescopes off the ground. So we can't build them, say, on a mountain in Hawaii or anywhere else. We actually have to do X-ray space telescopes. So there's something called the Chandra X-ray telescope, not to be mistaken for Chanda X-ray telescope. that does X-ray astronomy, and the Chandra mission has lasted for a long time, and at some point that telescope's going to stop working and we would like to have better technology. So there are various X-ray missions going up. I'm involved in three of them. One of them is a NASA mission, that's Strobex. Another one, and then there are two more, one involving the European Space Agency alone, and another one involving the European Space Agency and the Chinese Space Agency. And for all of these, I'm very interested in a very specific thing, which is, does dark matter interacting with neutron stars produce an X-ray signature that we can observe? And specifically, the dark matter particle that I work on is the axion. And so there's some possibility that the axion interacts in interesting ways with the neutron star, and that we might be able to see an observational signature of this.
Right. And Chanda, I want to find out a bit more about axions for our listeners to know what it is and why you're particularly interested in it. But we are going to take a short station break. There's a lot more that we're going to be discussing, including racism in science and decolonizing science and the physics of melanin and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back. history books got it all wrong, so I come to you with a song. In 1810, con el gran grito de pasión, se levantaron con razón. Black and brown fighting together on a day I'll always remember. En el 5 de mayo, con el grito de gallo, black, white and brown bleeding together on a day I'll always remember. Really, it hasn't been that long, so just in case Cat Williams had you guessing, let me kick y'all down with a little history lesson. In the 19th century, while the U.S. promoted degradation, annihilation with its military and U.S. Navy, Mexico got rid of the caste system, voted for its first indigenous president, even getting rid of legalized slavery.
And that music, it's the song is It's Movement Time. The artist Las Cafeteras, they are out of East Los Angeles. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And we're also on Twitter at So True Radio. So today, I would actually like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the great state of Washington. And we are having a one-hour special today. We're continuing our occasional series of cosmology on Sojourner Truth. And our guest is Dr. Chanda Prescott Weinstein, a research associate in theoretical physics at the University of Washington, one of the few Black women, I think she was number 62, who have earned their PhD in physics in the United States. She did her undergraduate work at Harvard, a bachelor's degree in physics, astronomy, and astrophysics from Harvard University, a master's in astrophysics from University of California, Santa Cruz, a PhD in theoretical physics at the Perimeter Institute. And on the side, well, not really on the side, because she's very passionate about this, she is also the editor of the Offing Literary Online Magazine. Our listeners can go and check that out, you know, online. And she also now is part of a team of people doing work with dark matter and neutron stars, you know, X-ray probes with NASA, European and Chinese Space Agency. She's part of that project. So, and again, for people who are just joining us, for full disclosure, you might remember her name has Prescott in it. Well, guess what? Yes, she is indeed my daughter. And by the way, her middle name is Sojourner. Chanda, welcome back. Before our station break, you started to talk a bit about axions, and that is as it relates to the work that you're doing, you will be doing with the neutron star structure team in this Strobex project. So what is an axion?
Yeah, so actually, I'm just wrapping up a paper on axions with Ann Nelson, who is one of the actually far too few senior women in particle physics. She's incredibly accomplished, and so it's been quite the opportunity to work with her here at the University of Washington. So the axion actually has kind of an interesting history and is one of the few particles in physics, and actually one of the few theoretical ideas that can trace its origins back to a woman, Helen Quinn, who is now retired from the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. And the basic idea behind the axion was really to solve a problem with the standard model in particle physics. So it turns out you can write down the equations that we think govern particle physics, and these equations suggest that there is a phenomenon that we should see and we don't see it. And so people were trying to figure out how do we solve this problem. And so Helen Quinn and Roberto Pecci, who is an emeritus professor at UCLA, actually, came up with what is now known as the Pecci-Quinn mechanism to resolve this. And they put out a paper about it. And Frank Wilczek at MIT called them up and said, you guys realize that this mechanism involves an additional particle. And they said, oh, we were so focused on this other thing that we hadn't really thought about that. And eventually, Frank Wilczek named this particle the axion. So that's kind of where the axion comes from. It was designed to solve a problem that we still have with the standard model. And I know over the last few years, there's been a lot of discussion about the discovery of the Higgs particle at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. And so people kind of have this impression that particle physics is kind of done, but there's actually still this problem. So a few years after kind of all of this stuff with the axion initially unfolded, it was realized by Pierre Sakivi and some others that the axion had the right properties to be a good dark matter particle candidate. And that's really how, I know it's kind of an involved story, but I think it's such a great example of how science works, that the axion was not invented to solve the dark matter problem, but it's also now one of our most popular and increasingly popular, I think, dark matter candidates. But that's really where it comes from.
Yeah, so it may be a dark matter candidate. Right. So why are you keen on axions and working with axions?
So I would say, you know, this is a part of science that we don't really talk about a lot, but how do you select what problems you work on and where do you focus your energies, especially as a theoretical physicist? Because in theoretical physics, most of what you do is going to be disproven a lot of the time, right? You're just making up ideas that might be real, but many of them won't be real, and then you're just kind of testing them. And it's certainly that way with dark matter candidates, that we have no idea which one is correct, but you know, you have to invest your time somehow. I like the axion partly because it solves two problems at once, potentially. And in fact, even if we find another particle and there's so much of it that it makes up all of the dark matter, we still are interested in the axion because it is related to this mechanism that solves this problem in particle physics. So I think I like it for that reason. It's robust, that we still need it one way or the other, even if it's not the dark matter particle. But I will also admit that irrationally, I look for things that are present me with interesting mathematical problems, or mathematical problems that I would enjoy solving.
Back to math.
Back to math, absolutely. I think I am at heart much more of a mathematician than really a physicist or an astrophysicist in any way. And the axion has presented me with some interesting mathematical problems, and also maybe some interesting what we would call phenomenology, how the axion behaves if it is the dark matter. It can behave differently from some other dark matter candidates. So it can do some fantastical things like forming something we call a Bose-Einstein condensate, where all of the particles act together to act like one superparticle. So they develop kind of almost like a hive mind kind of mentality and act like one. So I find that a totally fascinating process, and axions do that, and a lot of other dark matter candidates don't. So I just enjoy exploring that idea.
Right, and so just 2 points, quick things here. I do recall you talking about the beauty of mathematics, and I was really quite struck, because I never thought about mathematics that way, since I hated math and am terrible at it. But also, I think to your grandmom, dark matter may be our ancestors, right? That's how she, you know, kind of, you know, got that part of it. But moving on, Chanda, you have also written about the physics of melanin, science, and the chaotic social construct of race. Why that topic? What do you mean? And how do you see the physics of melanin and the kind of, as you in your article describe, a renewed interest in melanin? Just break that down a little bit for us, and also explain to people even what melanin is.
Right. So, you know, so melanin is the molecule that gives skin color. So people of African descent tend to have more of it than people of European descent, although, you know, as demographics of societies change, that is changing as well. And in fact, there are different, as you mentioned, there are different types of melanin. So the type of melanin that gives our skin color is called eumelanin. There's actually also a melanin called neuromelanin. And it turns out that scientists still don't really understand why we have neuromelanin. But it's called neuromelanin because it appears in our neural system. And so it's been found, but nobody quite knows what it does. So there are some open questions there. I hope some of the kids who might be listening would be interested in solving that problem. So why did I get interested in this? I think that, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about discrimination in science and racism in science and what would be different if that discrimination didn't exist. And I think also when I was in high school, I must have been in 11th grade, there was a day for girls in science at Harvey Mudd, which you took me to. I don't know if you remember doing this, Mom. And as part of the day for girls, they showed us exactly how sodium, like streetlights, work. I don't know if you remember any of this, but basically they showed that you put electricity through sodium gas and the gas turns orange because of the frequency that sodium emits photons at. So if you give energy to a molecule or an atom, there's going to be a frequency of light that resonates with that. And so in the case of sodium, it's 589 nanometers, which is about that orange that I think most of us who grew up in or live in urban areas in the United States are familiar with. So this is something I've always been fascinated by. That demonstration at Harvey Mudd was mind-blowing for me. And I've always loved spectra. That's kind of like, if I were an observational astronomer, that's probably the thing that I would work with. And it's actually something that, you know, Sarah Tuttle knows quite a bit about, my co-investigator in the Philosophy of Science grant. So we're always kind of thinking about these things. And then I started to think, well, you know, color is related to how light interacts with things. And so why haven't I started to wonder about why does the color of people's skin look the way that it does? And what does that mean? And how does it work? And that was kind of how I came to the question of what is the physics of melanin. And then actually the way I ended up writing about it is I was contacted by an editor for a magazine and she said, I'm interested in having you write about this. And I said, well, here are various things that I could write about. And she said, I like that one. So I was kind of displeased with her for picking that topic, but I'm really happy she knew what she was doing as an editor. So this is a sign that you should listen to your editor. But that's how that article came about. And I guess I would add that, like, as I say in the article, that it's kind of stunning that it took me so long, you know, almost half my life being trained as a physicist, before I asked the question of how does my mom's skin work? How does my skin work? I think that it's really sad, actually. So there's sort of a sad postscript to that we're sort of trained not to find that basic question about ourselves interesting.
Right, and just looking at the clock, the time is just flying by here, Chanda. But in the article on physics of melanin, you say that science and society co-construct one another, and that there's perhaps never a more salient site for this lesson than on skin with high melanin content. What do you mean by science and society co-constructing one another?
Well, I would say, you know, those of us who are people of color, I think, are pretty familiar with this, even if this isn't the language that we usually use to talk about it, that we know that scientific racism has been part of how society has been constructed, that people like Thomas Jefferson and others justified their ownership of Black people as slaves or their treatment of Black people as slaves by arguing that somehow Black people were intellectually and morally inferior because of their skin color, right? So there's this fundamental connection, that this belief that this scientific thing, or you know, this thing that's really about our biology and about the physics of the universe, somehow was an intellectual and moral indicator. And in that sense, science was used to justify the construction of a society which, you know, the United States, I don't know if this is okay for me to say, but the United States is fundamentally built out of the theft of native land and then the theft of African-American labor to turn that land into capital. And that's really how American capitalism came into existence. It's the basis of the American economy. And that is very much tied into scientific justifications for treating Native people and Black people in that way. So that's, I think, a really good example of how science and society work together to build structures that serve those in power.
Right. And when you say also in that article, the physics of melanin science and the chaotic social construct of race, and you say also that melanin is the stuff of Afrofuturist techno dreams. What do you mean by that?
So, you know, because I would say, you know, I haven't done a massive study about this, but I would say that because of racism, for a long time, nobody really paid attention to the physics of melanin because it was just like, oh, that's the thing that makes Black people inferior. I think that's how a lot of people thought about it. And then recently, people realized that it also protects, melanin protects people from the sun and can reduce the incidence of skin cancer. And so as, you know, more paler people have gotten skin cancer, people have become a lot more interested in what is melanin, how does it work, and making synthetic melanin. And it turns out that melanin is also what we call a disordered conductor. So, you know, metal conducts electricity, and that's, you know, this is why you should never stick a fork in an outlet, because metal strongly conducts electricity. So disordered conductors are unusual because depending on the temperature, they either act as a conductor or an insulator, so something that won't conduct electricity at all. And this is related to a technology that people are trying to develop now called superconductors. And the reason superconductors are so interesting is because they can reduce electricity waste. There are a lot of reasons it's interesting. One reason we would be interested in it as the general public is that it can make our electricity use more efficient. And this is particularly important as we think about global warming and reducing waste. So understanding the physics of melanin can possibly help us develop better and greener technologies. And so I really think of that as kind of Afrofuturistic.
Yeah. Melanin and green technology. Who would have thought so? Okay. Do we have, because I'd like to talk a bit, get your reaction about the March for Science. And anything you want to say about racism and science. But let's just hear a little bit from Bill Nye calling out lawmakers at the recent March for Science.
We are marching today to remind people everywhere, our lawmakers especially, of the significance of science for our health and prosperity. The process of science has enabled humankind to discover the laws of nature. This understanding has in turn enabled us to feed and care for the world's billions, build great cities, establish effective governments, create global transportation systems, explore outer space.
Well, I don't know about establish effective governments, but Chanda, this is really not fair because literally you have about a minute and a half just to say quickly about your reaction to the March for Science and a quick final thought. We're going to have to come back and talk more in depth about the racism in science. Chanda.
You know, I think my job as a scientist is to be skeptical and ask questions about the way things work, sometimes to the frustration of my parents. And I have a lot of questions about the comments that Bill Nye made in that speech. You know, before the conquistadores arrived in what we would now call Central America, Mayan civilizations had many great cities. Were they great because of science? I think that, you know, it's very easy to assign science this kind of incredible, almost religious role in improving society. But I look around the world and I see different things than maybe Bill Nye sees. I see that human produced global warming. People say man-made, and maybe that's actually really appropriate in a variety of ways, has come from our burning of fossil fuels to use technologies that we've invented. And because of that, people, especially people in the global South, but also, you know, in the American South, are suffering because of the impact that this has had on our weather. And, you know, I remember how much time you spent in New Orleans after Katrina. And so for me, science is more complicated than that. I think that science by itself doesn't solve human problems. I think that humans make decisions about how science will be used. And sometimes it can get people killed, like in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that at other times, yes, you know, having clean water in the places that have access to clean water can be a game changer. And, you know, my hope is that, for example, Flint will get clean water.
Right. Well, on that note, sad to say, Chanda, we are going to have to leave it there, but we'll need to have you back. We appreciate you taking the time with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank our guests, Chanda Sue Prescott-Weinstein, the Sojourner Truth team. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our assistant producer and our engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio